Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. Well, we've had a series of research interviews. One with Ricardo Monzi from Brazil, and then Martin Auerkerk from the Netherlands, and then Jo-Jan Jonkers from the Netherlands, and they're all three a bit different in their research. And Jo-Jan has introduced me by email to a young man named Justin Stein. And it took me a long time because I was traveling and so on to connect with Justin. And I realized that this interview would be a great companion for the others. So I guess I'm developing a bit of a theme here about research. You know, as I've said in other shows, in the beginning, the research that was being done with Reiki was more about, did it exist? How do we prove its existence? How do we prove that it actually has value for human beings? And that is it consistent? And I would say that what has happened in the years following is that people are now, after having practiced Reiki for decades, literally, people are coming to the place where they're interested in Reiki and their mind is such that they want to explore the effect that Reiki has on people. Well, Justin comes from a little different place. It's more of a historical perspective, I believe, but we shall soon see. Welcome, Justin, to the show.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, Justin, as usual, I would love for you to tell your Reiki story. I'm very interested in how you met Reiki, what led up to taking the chance that Reiki might be for you, and so on. Can you?
Yeah, sure.
That'd be great.
I guess my interest in what might be called alternative medicine or, you know, different kind of ways of approaching healing really goes back to when I was a kid. My mom is a longtime transcendental meditation practitioner, and I grew up being taken to a very close family friend who's a powerful healer who does applied kinesiology and also kind of has a spiritual, psychic kind of connection going on. And so from an early age, you know, I was kind of introduced to these types of modalities, you know, outside of kind of the Western rational way of understanding the body. And kind of my mom, you know, very kind of spiritual woman. And so then maybe fast forward to when I was in university, I was studying philosophy. And I had been home for, I think it was over the summer vacation. I was working a summer job. And I ran into a friend of mine from high school, and he asked me if I knew anything about chakras. And I said, no, you know, I don't. And he said, well, you really have to come see this thing my brother is doing. I think he'd be really interested in it. And so I ended up taking this first level class of another modality called spiritual human yoga. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't. I was really interested to find out more about that.
Okay, yeah, it's a chakra-based system developed by he's a Vietnamese guy who was based out of Thailand, and he also has a center in the U.S. in St. Louis, and he basically teaches this chakra-based healing system with, you know, where you, and kind of like the way Reiki is structured around different levels, there's a first level where you learn the basics of the practice, and higher levels where you are, you know, initiated or attuned into kind of deeper, more spiritual levels as you go on. So it starts off really as a meditative practice, as a healing practice, but as it goes on, it becomes more and more spiritual. And So I did the first few levels of that with, and it's a seven level system. And so I did the first couple of levels with that with my friend's brother, who was a teacher for those levels. But then to go to the higher levels, you had to go to these big conferences that they had, where the master would come and what have you. And for me, it was a very eye-opening experience doing these meditations. I had experiences I couldn't really explain with, you know, with anything I'd really experienced before, feeling, you know, one of the basic meditations was meditating on your crown chakra. And I was feeling kind of, you know, activity in my crown chakra. You know, you do these healings where you're also like, you know, some forms of Reiki, you're supposed to do this meditation every day for 21 days at the beginning, when you first are attuned to the system. And, you know, doing this meditation was a kind of, yeah, it was a profound experience for me. And doing these healings both on myself and on other people, I felt, you know, really powerful things. Much like Reiki, I remember feeling sweating sensations. I remember feeling the energy flowing through me. And I was like, wow, this is really something. But then when I went to the national conference to go to the higher levels, I felt really uncomfortable with it. It was very structured like a religion, like a new religious movement, where the master was saying things that really made me uncomfortable. I remember him saying that now that we had been attuned to this, I think it was the fourth level, that we were in psychic communication with him at all times. And that if we had any questions, we could pose the questions kind of in our inmost mind, and that we would hear his voice answering them. And it made me feel really uncomfortable. I felt like, you know, that it might, surely that's my own conscious or higher self or something. You know, your own unconscious mind or something like that. And that he's trying to co-opt that and take kind of control over people's, you know, what's really, I feel like they're almost your most inmost gift, right? Your inner voice. And that made me feel really like, oh my gosh, what kind of organization have I gotten involved in? And so that was kind of my introduction, where I felt like, okay, there's certainly something to all of this energy work and you know, higher self stuff. But at the same time, it really could be kind of, I don't know, used in a lot of different ways, I guess.
Uh-huh. So I'm interested, if I could back up a tad bit.
Yeah, sure.
So when you were young, did you also get involved with Did you also meditate with your mom in transcendental meditation?
Well, with TM, the way it works, right, is that there is an initiation where you're given a personal mantra.
Right.
And so I never did that. But I definitely, my mom, she had like cassettes with guided meditations.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So we did visualizations of white light entering the crown. I mean, like, that's kind of, you know, primed for this kind of thing already.
Right.
We did, you know, different meditations of imagining white light entering your body and finding any darkness or finding any stress and relaxing the stress. You know, we did yoga together. We did, I don't think any chanting or anything like that, but I definitely had, before encountering this chakra system, I had definitely experiences with visualization and kind of feeling a connection with some kind of cosmic energy. And yeah, so I had experiences like that from, definitely my childhood. And I think they got more intense during my, teenage years when I started being interested in meditation and things like that.
Uh-huh. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
That's good. It's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. So, your story.
So then the next step was, I really wanted to do this Buddhist studies program. I had been reading Hermann Hesse.
Yes. And
the book Siddhartha was kind of one of my favorites. This is around the time, I think near the end of high school, beginning of university. I got involved in a meditation club at university, And I found out about this program. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a study abroad program run with Antioch College. And they do an experiential Buddhist studies program.
Oh, cool.
And the original program is in Bodh Gaya, India, where Siddhartha Gautama, you know, was enlightened, you know, or awakened, sitting under the Bodhi tree in heaven. And I thought this was, like, perfect. You know, this is exactly what I want to do.
That's beautiful.
You learn these different meditation styles. You learn how to do Vipassana. You learn how to do Zen meditation. You learn how to do a Tibetan form of meditation. And I was totally like, this is what I want to do. And I applied to the program. I was accepted to the program. And my father started doing research on the area around Bodh Gaya. And he got very anxious about his only son going off to a lawless state in India where there were bandits and who knows what would happen. And so he started doing more research and he saw that Antioch was doing a pilot program in Japan. And so he said, well, how about, you know, you do the Buddhist studies program, but you know, see if you can get into the Japan program instead of the India program. And that is so funny. I mean, the things that set you on your path, but that was one of these moments where, you know, I mean, now, you know, I've been studying the Japanese language for 10 years or whatever. It's because of, you know, this decision, you know, my dad made, whatever, 20 years ago.
That's amazing.
And, not 20 years ago. I'm not that old yet, over a decade ago.
Okay. So that's another question that I realize I have.
Okay.
We don't know each other very well and I haven't ever met you in person. So I'm just wondering, when did all this happen? Like how many years ago?
So I'm 33 now, and that happened when I was going into my junior year of university. So that was 1999. So I think the spiritual human yoga stuff, it might have even been that summer, the summer of 99. And then I was going to Japan that fall.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and so when I was in Japan, I was still doing the shock, you know, in addition. So we stayed in different temples. We stayed in one temple, actually very close to, Kodama, where it's on Hiezan. Hiezan is a sacred temple for, the Tendai sect of Buddhism. And, it's just northeast of Kyoto. So it's actually literally maybe two mountains over from Kodamayama. You know, where Isui Sensei had his experience. And, we were staying at that temple there. We went to, Nara, where we did, Zen meditation at those two, Zazen. And then we also went to Koyasan, which is a mountain retreat, a little bit southeast of there, which was the center of Shingon Buddhism, which, some research indicates has some connections perhaps with, some of the Reiki practices, which are really interesting and maybe we could talk about later. And then we learned another form of meditation there. And then we came back to Hiezan, and stayed at a temple. Well, the temple we stayed at was, Jodo. So like Pure Land. Yeah. And, so we did a calligraphy practice that was kind of a meditative practice of copying sutras, in that sect. And so, you know, in this experiential program, I was learning kind of new meditation techniques. And also I was practicing this chakra healing on people and had some really profound experiences, with people where I had one friend who had chronic sinus problems and putting my hands on him, it's just a couple of fingers, placed on different, you know, kind of chakra centers along the spine and what have you. He had these, I mean, really, you could hear the popping in his sinuses and the mucus would be running down his nose and down his face. I mean, like he was really,
amazing.
And so, yeah. And then other things where there's an intuitive diagnosis technique where, you know, I would put my fingers on the wrist of the person, almost like you were taking a pulse.
Uh-huh.
And, I would be able to say to people, wow, you really have a disturbance in this part of your body. In this system, they said that basically your energy or energies would go through you into the person and then come back, and you could feel in your own body where the person had, you know, deficiencies or blockages or what have you. And so I was able to do diagnoses on a level that I had never done before and really kind of surprising with surprising feedback where people say, wow, yeah, I really do have a problem with that part of my body. It's amazing. You can feel that. And so the one level, you know, I'm learning new meditation techniques. On another level, I feel like, you know, this kind of energy work that I'm involved in is kind of going to another place as well. And then I had this experience with a few friends where they were studying a new religious movement. And we went and stayed with the new religious movement at their temple. And while we were there, this wasn't my research project, but it was actually a friend of mine's research project. We were doing interviews with mostly elderly female Japanese women through translator sometimes, or sometimes some of them spoke a little English. And hearing about their remarkable experiences since they had converted to this religious movement, they said, you know, they weren't sleeping much. They didn't need to eat much. They were, had these premonitions. One of them, she had lived in Kobe, and before the 1995 earthquake, she knew something was going to happen, and she got her family to leave the city. And then the earthquake had, you know, things where people were recounting remarkable experiences with healing and with kind of psychic phenomena. And so I was kind of, you know, interested. And that was kind of the beginning of me seeing that these kind of phenomena could be both, you know, very profound experientially, but also could maybe tell us something about what it meant to be human, you know, the study of religion as an academic discipline. And, you know, to look at, you know, how did these women who lived in a very, you know, advanced, you know, society that had, you know, all kinds of technological advances, and how do they reconcile, you know, these beliefs, which really on some level, you know, seem to be kind of almost like magical, or, you know, almost, you know, not rational, not scientific. How do they reconcile that with living in this modern society and with, you know, and so that was kind of this beginning of this period of being interested in, I don't know, looking at these types of unusual phenomena of almost miraculous, or I don't know what you want to call it, but the paranormal phenomena as a academic discipline, or from an academic. And so I, when I came back to my university the following year, I made an application to do a kind of anthropological study of energy healing. And I got a grant from the Watson Foundation. And the point of my study, or the pitch of my study, was to look at different modalities that all claim to work with energy or invisible energies, and to kind of contrast ones that were more religious, or said that, you know, the healing was done out of an ethical obligation, that it was unethical to charge people, that you need, you know, it should be kind of your work from a, out of your kind of duty to humankind, and other ones that had been more kind of commercialized and said, you know, okay, this is kind of my profession. This is not, it's not, you know, my people who weren't trying to be saints, but people who were saying, listen, I'm a professional healer and I need to be respected as a professional. Uh-huh. And so I was contrasting those. And so it was during that year where I first really learned about Reiki. And it was in the UK. I remember I was looking up these healers to talk to in the UK, and there were a few different modalities I interacted with. And this one woman, I had this kind of this strange kind of, I don't know, psychic kind of experience with this woman, and she was a Reiki healer. And that was kind of how I was kind of like, I had this, I don't know. I kind of had this remarkable experience. It's kind of a long story, but it's this really kind of remarkable coincidence. And the woman at the center of this coincidence was a Reiki practitioner. So there was, it kind of got on my radar, in that way. And then from UK, I went to India, where Reiki is very, very popular. I actually have written a little thing about it. It's kind of an exploratory piece, but it's something I'm very interested in researching more in the future, is Reiki's popularity in India, where I don't know, it's hard to get stats, you know, for Reiki practitioners. It's a very loosely organized network, but I believe it's quite possible that there are more Reiki practitioners in India than anywhere else in the world.
Really?
Yeah. That if you look at, there's an English language newspaper called The Times of India, and if you Google search their website and Reiki, there was a period in the early mid-2000s where there were a number of articles about Reiki, and one of them, the woman, she's writing in about 2004, and she says, you know, you remember a few years ago when everybody's auntie was a Reiki master? You remember when everybody was learning Reiki? And like, she's like, you know, what happened to Reiki? Why has it declined? And so, you know, maybe it's not as popular now as it was 10 years ago when I was there or whatever. I was there in 2001. But I mean, the fact that she would reference it in that way, where she, you know, usually when there's an article about Reiki in a Western newspaper, they have to explain, you know, what is Reiki? Reiki comes from Japan. She had just kind of assumed that the readership was familiar with it. Right. So there's kind of this really markedly different, pervasiveness, I think, of Reiki in India, at least in the early 2000s. I haven't been back since 2001, so I can't speak to the contemporary scene there. But I know also not just in India, but in the Indian diasporas or the South Asian diasporas in Toronto, where I live now, that Reiki, you know, when I talk to, you know, white Torontonians, I'd say maybe one out of three, one out of two say, oh yeah, I know someone who does it. When I talk to, you know, South Asian Torontonians, almost everybody knows about Reiki.
So, fascinating.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. So anyway, where I received my Reiki 1 attunement was part of this participant observation research I was doing, and it was in India, in northern India, outside of a city called Dharamsala. And it was a really interesting experience for me. It was, you know, kind of, it was the first modality that I learned during that year. During that year, I was attuned to or initiated into a few different modalities. And I was kind of combining different modalities in my own personal practice, mm-hmm. On myself and on others, and was kind of experimenting to see kind of what worked for me and what worked for others. And So that was where I received my Reiki 1. And then I ended up going to Japan that year, returning to Japan that year, and doing more research there. And throughout the year, I had been collecting different literature. And one thing I was really amazed by with Reiki was how little was really known about its origins. That, you know, we have really conflicting stories about Usui. If you look at different books written by people at different times, they, you know, will say Usui was a Christian, Usui was a Buddhist, Usui was just a spiritual guy, he wasn't affiliated with any religion. You know, there's all these different stories, and that was something that was like a seed that was planted then, that then would flourish later in my master's program, with that ended up kind of being the center of my master's research. But then I went to Japan. I met, I'm sure you know, Hyakuten Inamoto.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't? Okay. He's the founder of, Komyo Reiki. He is a Buddhist monk. He is, very interesting guy. Very, very interesting guy. He speaks very good English. And I was researching an article that actually just got published. It's funny because I wrote it in 2002, you know, when I was there, and it just got published, you know, a couple months ago. So it took about 10 years. But I was working on an article about these Japanese new religious practices that I was looking at. Jōrei.
Yes.
Yeah, and another similar one to Jōrei by another religion called Mahikari. And,
oh, yeah.
And I was looking at these because both of them say that they are practices where they project light out of their hands in order to do healing. And I was kind of contrasting them with Reiki, as well as with Qigong and with Kundalini yoga practices, which all also say that they use energies, but Qigong and Kundalini Yoga and Reiki all talk about balancing energy as kind of the central way of understanding what health is, whereas the Jōrei and Mahikari forms of healing talk about purity and purification, and that you need to get these clouds out of you and purify the body. And I was kind of interested in all that, and I ended up going to a Reiki share and talking with Hyakuten, and going to a Reiki share that he hosted as part of my research in Japan. And we were doing a Reiki share, and I had done what I had been doing on myself and on some other people, where I was kind of combining different energy practices. And it was this really intense experience where I felt like I was, like, there was too much energy going through me into the person who was receiving it. And he was on the table and he was like shaking, and I couldn't take my hands off of him. I felt like this experience, like when you like touch an electric cable and there's like the connection where you almost can't pull your hand away.
Yeah.
And oh my God, it was like too much. And from that experience, I was like, okay, listen, you know, it's not ethical to be experimenting on different types of modalities when you're treating other people. That it's you know, if you're doing it on yourself, one thing, but like, and so from then I became kind of interested in the kind of different types of what is kind of a kind of really more like gentle practice that, you know, is not going to have these types of dramatic results, because I was kind of scared by that experience.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. I just would like for you to know that's, I don't know how intense it was, but that seems very typical, well, not unusual, let me put it that way, for a Reiki treatment.
Okay. I think one of the first times I'd experienced something like that.
And it is scary.
And the gentleman I was treating was like an older guy, and I had my hands out in the heart position.
Yeah.
And I was like afraid. I don't know. I was afraid I was like going to give him a heart attack or something.
Right. No, I totally understand. But it's very interesting. So yeah. I can understand you're pulling back. But anyway, that's fine.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear the description.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I'm not so sure for your listeners. Maybe because you're so experienced in this that it may probably reassuring for a lot of people to hear that's, you know, it's okay to have that. I definitely felt like there was a lot of energy going through that. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, so that year was very interesting. But I came out of it with new respect for Reiki, as opposed to some of these other healing systems that I kind of had different feelings about.
Uh-huh.
And then I lived in New York City for 5 years. I became a school teacher, and I taught middle school in Brooklyn for 4 years. And all the while, I kind of had this research that I had done kind of in the back of my mind, and I was kind of like, you know, I really enjoy teaching children, but maybe I'd like to go on and do adult education, you know, at a university level. And at the same time, I was interested in continuing my research, and so I began to apply for graduate schools in programs that I thought would support the study of energy work. And the first year I applied to a number of really good programs where I was proposing an interdisciplinary project where I maybe could work with both, because I have kind of a scientific background as well a little bit, where I was hoping to work with, and also during my year in my year of study abroad, I met with a scientist and kind of mystic in Tokyo, named Motoyama Hiroshi, and he has a university in Encinitas, California, actually called the California Institute of Human Science, as well as his center in Tokyo called the Motoyama Institute of Life Physics, and he does this kind of scientific study of bioenergy, And I was very interested in that. He had built different machines that could measure, one that measures the acupuncture meridians, another one that measures chakra function. And I was very interested in this kind of merging of scientific and spiritual things. And so I was proposing this study that would kind of take a historical, social scientific, and like biophysical perspective on energy healing to try to provide, you know, a history, a ethnographic, historical, ethnographic, and kind of biophysical explanations of what was going on. And programs were not interested. I was told by one person, like, yeah, you can't do all of this. You kind of have to pick your thing. And I didn't really have the science background. In undergraduate, I majored in philosophy, and I'd taken, you know, a lot of humanities classes. Although I had a minor in environmental studies, and I had taken some biology, maybe to the third year level, where, you know, I was actually doing laboratory work, but I didn't have, you know, really the chops. I'd have to have gone back to school probably to do some prereqs in order to do the biophysics stuff. And I ended up applying to and getting accepted to the University of Hawaii, where I did a master's in Japanese religion. And I did for my master's thesis work, a research on exactly what I mentioned earlier, the kind of the different stories that had been told of Usui Sensei, and kind of what they told us about these different kind of audiences that were trying, like we are, you know, trying to make sense of their experiences with these kind of supernatural healing energies, but in different cultural contexts at different times. And so, that's my master's thesis. And I worked on that in Hawaii. And then I taught community college in Hawaii for a year, doing religious studies. And I really liked it, and I decided, okay, I'll go for the PhD as well. And so that's what I'm working on right now. So I've been talking for a long time, but that's my story. Gotta get us up to the present. But so, yeah, I definitely am kind of coming at it from this historical kind of perspective and a cultural, like it's kind of a cultural history or a social history kind of perspective. But at the same time, I also have in my own life kind of these profound experiences that, you know, I can't really explain. There's a number of different ways, I guess. You can understand them on a number of different levels, I suppose. Yeah. So.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to wrap my head around you teaching children.
Oh, and, yeah. Yeah. I taught science. It was really fun. I miss it. I still have dreams about my students and stuff.
Oh, that's neat, because I imagine that it's very creative also.
Yeah, well, especially, you know, there's certain curriculum, but you have so much, I mean, in terms of how to structure your lessons and how to get students involved and engaged, there's a lot of room for bringing, you know, your creativity and your vision into your classroom.
Uh-huh, great, yeah. Great. So, did you ever like take second degree or?
I'm sorry.
Did you ever?
I missed that part of the story. Yeah, while I was in Japan, I actually did a distance attunement, which I don't know how you feel about, but I know it's a little bit controversial in some parts of the Reiki world, but yeah, I did a distance attunement for second degree while I was in Japan as part of kind of my. Because I wanted to learn more about, you know, Reiki and the symbols and about, you know, and so, that's how I kind of came into that, was through just doing internet research and trying to find out what was going on. And I didn't know if the master I mentioned earlier, he had started this different lineage, and so I would have had to do my Reiki one again if I wanted to do it through him. And it seemed like, I don't know, at the time it seemed like a lot of money, and who knows what would have happened if I had redone my Reiki one and Reiki two with him. Maybe I'd have a different perspective, or, you know, on, cause his lineage, the whole thing about his lineage is that it's, through a woman who had studied with Hayashi. So it was, you know, what they call like traditional Japanese Reiki lineage or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And so, he was very accepting of me as, you know, someone who had been, because in India, I think I would say, you know, probably 99% of the practitioners in India are through, you know, what are sometimes called Western Reiki lineages, or, you know, lineages that come through your grandmother. In Japan, there's, I'd say it's more almost 50-50 from my experiences that there are certain lineages that came back to Japan from the U.S., and there are other lineages, especially in the last 10 years or so, that have been promoted as, you know, authentically Japanese lineages or what have you, which I think is quite, I mean, in my master's thesis, I question that type of narrative as well. I never did my training with him, which I wonder kind of what, if my path would have really changed a lot if I had. It's interesting. I needed to live for 12 months on my research funds. And I remember feeling at the time that I was spending way too much money in Japan, that like it was so expensive in Japan. And I was like, wow, if I spend all this money on these attunements right now, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it the 12 months or something. I just remember having that kind of rationality, kind of rationalizing it. And so, yeah, I ended up getting a distance attunement for, the second level.
Uh-huh. So, can I just do my own research then?
Sure, sure.
So I've never met anybody, actually, or talked to anybody specifically who have done distant attunements. And I'm just wondering, did they work?
You know, I mean, I feel like when I do the power symbol especially, and also, I mean, I feel like when I do distance Reiki, that uh-huh. it has an effect. Right now, actually, my grandfather is going through something, and I've been sending him distance, and I feel like there's something going on. So, I feel like I've received the symbols in a respectful and meaningful way, you know?
Uh-huh. Good. Yeah. Well, on some level, individually, that's all that counts. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have my, well, I don't know what you would call it, descriptive word, but I have my own concern about them, not that they don't work. I mean, mm-hmm. So this is something that may or may not interest you. I'm very interested in how or in what the lessons are that that are brought to us by our spiritual practice. And I consider Reiki to be my spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what has happened for me is that I feel that we're in a transitional period. So in the past, especially, hundreds of years ago, when the people, the difference between what I would call the everyday man and the people who held spirituality as a part of their life
mm-hmm.
was very different. The spiritual man had this kind of daily practice that was very practical. And then there were these monks and sometimes women, nuns, who were cloistered, and the division between the two was very great. And there was this kind of feeling for me of these people in the cloisters and the convents and the monasteries holding a kind of spiritual place for all humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And then what has happened in my lifetime, because, of course, I'm much older than you are, political and sociological things happen, like the communication systems,
right?
The political movement of the Chinese and the Russian and so on, and all the colonization and so on has created this interesting process, which we are moving, which has come through my time, which is that everything is coming out now to the public. And everybody gets to choose, so that people's spiritual practice can become eclectic, ecumenical, and sometimes really confusing.
That's
because
true.
Of that. And it's very interesting that we all are kind of making our own mix. Like somebody can do Vipassana meditation, and I mean, your story is like very typical, I think, of many, many people your age.
Yeah.
Because there's so much available. Like when it was my age, it was like you went to either the Catholic Church or a few Christian churches, or maybe if you are really avant-garde, you know, you ended up, because of where I lived in the Midwest, you could be a Mormon or Church of the Latter-day Saints, or maybe you could be a Baptist, or maybe you could, you know, that was like the kind of extreme of my own religious upbringing.
Right.
And so to have all these other different thoughts and religious and spiritual practices available creates this mix.
Yeah.
Now I feel, and in those times, these old times, it was very important for you to have a guide, for a human being to be able to surrender to another human being, not because that human being has more power or more wisdom even than you, but because of the act of surrender, there is a part of that that allows a part of us as a human being to open. And I feel like there's no other way for this to open except for surrender.
Well, is what you're saying. I mean, it's funny. I'm also thinking of you know, the rise of like romance, in like the idea of surrender as like love. You know, I mean, people talk about you know, love, loving a guru or something, but I feel like the compartmentalization of things that used to be, you know, in more organized or more institutionalized religions, and then as you're talking about kind of this transition to a more individualized spiritualities, that people find, people maybe compartmentalize that, or different aspects of religiosity into parts of your life that you maybe think of as more secular, like, you know, romantic relationships or things like that. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of these, you said, I mean, there is a very human kind of need or a human experience that you can, I don't know, that these things have kind of been teased out from religion and maybe put into other parts of your life. You know, people find spirituality in all kinds of things these days, I guess. You know, there's some people who I'm not spiritual at all, but then for them, art or nature or whatever is where they find their connection.
Right.
Yeah.
So the next phase is happening, and I feel like we become, we need to surrender, but then what do we surrender to? And is the ultimate surrender to ourselves? This is my question. This is, you know, kind of what I'm working on these days.
But like,
and,
you said, it'd be dangerous without a
problem. Excuse me, just let me finish my thought.
So
when we talk about the distant attunements, one of the things that concerns me is that there's not a person that you're actually having a physical connection with. I find that when I have my students sitting in front of me, there's an energetic transmission that happens that I'm very aware of, and they are also. And it happens not just through the initiation or the attunements, but it happens through every moment that I'm with them and whatever interaction we have. And so to take that out of the equation is a really interesting conundrum for me, because I see that it's important in the way that I teach. But then I think, well, there is no limitation on Reiki, the energy. So the question, does it work, is an interesting one for me, because it would alarm me if you had said, well, I took this distant attunement and I didn't feel like I got anything. That would alarm me, because then I would think, well, maybe the person that he connected with, or somehow, however you got this attunement, it wasn't really connected with the energy of Reiki, because I feel that there's no limitation on whether you get something from it. But is there another piece of the getting, if I may use kind of that kind of language, that you're missing that, and is that important? You know, you might be missing it, but maybe it's not so important in where you are now. And it might become more important later. I don't know. But I really have to trust in people's paths these days. You know, my path in the moment in the late 1970s was very unusual on one level. And now I see that it's repeated time and again through other people. So that's really interesting. And in that moment, I've had to live with what I thought was being different all these years. Now, in the world that you live in, which is, you know, you're 30 years younger, or maybe more younger than I am, your world is very different. It's much more complex, and you have much more choice, and it doesn't seem to faze you. You just take the choice that seems appropriate in the moment. And I feel that that, for me, is something that my generation would do well to learn about. So, you know, those are, that's what happens when I hear about your distant attunement and my thought processes and how it fits into not only my own understanding of what I teach in Reiki, but also this kind of global movement that's happening. Yeah. So that each one of us as individual human beings are becoming responsible for our own spirituality and our own relationship with spirit, whatever that means, you know, in the moment. So, you know, the internet and the communication process that we have on hand these days is can either be a challenge to traditional, what I call traditionalists like me, or it could be a movement into a kind of renaissance again that is like new thought. You know, I feel like we're on the cusp of this myself.
And the advances in technology and communication have allowed you to do this type of program where you're talking to people literally, you know, scattered all over the world. You know, and but at the same time, these conversations might be very different if we were sitting in the same room. You know, it's hard to say. You know, that we talked about physical co-presence as this powerful force, but at the same time, you know, the opportunities. You know, so that's lacking in these conversations where, you know, computer mediated communication, but then at the same time, the opportunity to speak with researchers in Brazil and in the Netherlands and in Canada from your home, you know, in Arizona. It's pretty remarkable as well. So
it
works both ways. You know, where there is, I think, a certain power in being in the same space with someone that can't be approximated through, you know, even if we had 3D holographic technologies or whatever. but at the same time, it's, yeah, like you said, we have this new possibility now.
Yeah, great. So, let's see. I think the next question I would have is that the paper that you did for your master's degree, which is about
stories about Usui. So,
right. comparing them.
But at the same time, not comparing them in like trying to find out which one is true, right? It's looking at them as kind of mythic constructions that, you know, we've come to realize, you know, that, we really just know very little about him. There's very little, hard data And some people have come to take the memorial stone as, you know, that is the true story. And, you know, but I'm saying, no, all of these stories are constructions by humans that reveal more about their authors than about the man himself. And so master's thesis, I almost use the stories as a way to unpack the narrator of the story and their audience, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so, okay, so for example, the memorial stone was written by, was actually written by this professor of literature at Tokyo National University, or it was Tokyo Imperial University at the time, Okada Masayuki, and I don't really know exactly his connection with people like Ushida, who took over, or some people say established, the Usuide Kiryoho Gakkai in the late 1920s Japan, but that the way that Okada describes Usui Sensei on the memorial tells us a lot about the time in which he developed that story, right? And the time in which he wrote that narration. And so another story I look at is a transcript from a recording of your grandmother telling, you know, the story of Reiki that I think most of your listeners are very familiar with, which again, we now know is not factually true, but it tells us a lot about kind of the way people will adapt kind of, there's a lot of parables about this, both in the Christian Bible and in Buddhist sutras, about how different listeners need to receive the truth in different ways, right? And so I really think of your grandmother as a genius in adapting a kind of a universal, you know, this universal energy or the truth of the Reiki practice for different types of audiences. And the story that we have from her from the late 1970s is this incredible myth. And she is, I think, taking elements of a lot of different, powerful myths and creating this, you know, what we know of as the story of Reiki. Usui as this Christian minister looking for the secret of Jesus's healing power and coming to America and the whole story. It's a very, very powerful story. And so kind of looking at that, what does it tell us about the people who she's speaking to at that time? What does it tell us about her own background? What is it, you know? And then looking at people from the 1980s talking about, you know, Reiki being brought from extraterrestrials to Earth, and people in the 1990s saying, well, Usui was this, you know, esoteric Buddhist, or people saying, you know, well, you know, he was kind of on the fringe, he was this spiritual guy. You know, all these different stories, they tell us a lot about the people who, kind of were telling these stories and the audiences they were speaking to. So that's the crux of my master's thesis.
Uh-huh. And is that published?
In
the sense that can read it, or?
Yeah, it's not. I had the option of putting it on ProQuest, which is a an electronic database that publishes graduate theses, but I chose not to because I was kind of thinking that I might want to develop it into a manuscript someday. But if people are interested, I will I can make available parts of it. I haven't made it available really yet. I feel like it's still a work in progress. That in the few years since I finished it, there are parts of it I'd like to go back and change, and so I don't really want to tie it down in a particular draft yet. If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I just wondered because that would be a question that I know that some of the listeners would have. So it's good to know.
Yeah.
And it's also I have to say that it really is heartening for me to hear that you have not put it, to hear what you've just said, because I feel that part of the nature of oral tradition is that the listener is also very important. Like, what do people remember hearing and how do they hear it? So for me, the way that I heard my grandmother tell the story, and I heard her tell it many, many different times, and some people would say many different versions, for instance. What I did was I took what I heard and have told the story basically the same for all these, you know, years I've been teaching, 30-some years. And, you know, the what I would call the factual research that has been done and has been published supports the story as she told it according to me. Okay. And what doesn't support it, though, are the assumptions that are made out of what is the information. Does that make sense to you?
Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So I'll say this again. So, for instance, people rely, some of the researchers have relied a lot on whether or not Mikao Usui shows up in university records.
Right.
And I think there's one critical assumption that is huge, and that is that everybody who goes to a university in the early 1900s would be recorded in their university records. And that is a huge assumption, and the only reason that I say that from my own authority, meaning my own experience, is that I used to work in the registrar's office at the University of Denver in the 1970s.
Hello.
And we were just coming into the computer age. So I helped put together the first online registration in the United States.
Wow.
For classes. But I tell you, we lost people all the time.
Sure.
And they had, you know, they were a typical registrar's office. I mean, they were dealing with thousands of people, tens of thousands of alumni, and you know, a lot of common names and a lot of people who were there just to take a few courses and not get a degree. So if you were thinking about Mikao Usui as a degree candidate, well, yes, probably you would maybe be able to find him somewhere. But if you were thinking about Mikao Usui as a person who was coming there just to take courses as an interested person, then they might not have recorded him at all.
That's
so
true, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. And there's a lot of these kind of assumptions that happen. So I like the way that you have taken this as a study of the people who are writing, because I think that's a very, very important point. Mikao Usui came from a certain background, and all of his life and the society around him shaped who he was. You know, he didn't just spring out of, you know, out of nowhere and come to Reiki. You know, the whole Japanese history culminates in some way in his sitting on the mountain. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's great. I like that. And I'd love to see your expansion of that, or you know, where you go next, because you're obviously on a path.
Right. Well, so that's what I'm working, that's what I'm working on now. Yeah. So I'm definitely still walking every day.
That's great.
My newest work is kind of looking at different ways. In a sense, I mean, it's a very related project, but not in the stories people were telling, but kind of in the ways that they describe their practices.
Oh, yeah.
And in relation to different categories. So when people think, you know, and so let's say we're talking about people in 1920s Tokyo, people in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian Islands in the late 1930s, 1940s, early 1950s, people, you know, in California and BC and, you know, Illinois in the 60s and 70s, what did they think how did they describe Reiki? What were they saying about Reiki in relation to these categories that are how we structure our thought and how we structure our lives? So categories like medicine, religion, science, Japan, you know, America, you know, like these kinds of like big categories. And, you know, they're very different the way that, so I've been speaking with some women who are, you know, serious elders. I mean, women who are in their 80s and 90s and one gentleman as well. But mostly women, who studied with your grandmother from 1938, into the 1950s. I hope to meet some more. And I think these are stories that have never really been told, in the Reiki world, about what was it like in 1938, 1942, 1949, Hilo and Honolulu, you know, studying with your grandmother. It's really, it's very different, you know, than what people who were studying in the late 1970s were, you know, I mean, she changed a lot and society changed a lot. And like we were saying, you know, about, you know, kind of how different people kind of almost need to hear different things, or, you know, can only accept, you know, a practice or a truth in a certain context, that, you know, these contexts were very different, obviously. And so that's kind of what I've been working on most recently, is that small section of kind of the bigger story, because these elders are only with us so long, right? So I want to get their stories while they're still around, but I'm interested in expanding that. I'm working with a researcher at Waseda University in Tokyo, which is one of the most prestigious universities in Japan, and she's working on, her dissertation is about contextualizing Reiki within the kind of the milieu. So 1920s Tokyo was a very exciting place for spiritual therapies, that there was a lot going on.
Oh, yeah.
And the same way you were talking about kind of this current age, in the US or wherever, you know, being an age where we're presented with all these foreign options, you know, that are novel and are, you know, profound and what have you, that in that period in Tokyo, there's the rise of these new professional classes who, are highly educated, you know, the people who are, you know, have gone to university and are interested in Western ideas and are interested in science and are interested in, you know, the kind of the future of bringing together, you know, science and religion and doing, you know, healing in ways that, you know, the kind of the future of medicine and, the power of the mind and the power of the spirit and all these, you know, it's a very exciting kind of period in the intellectual history of, I don't know what you want to call them, healing practices in Japan. And so she's working on kind of contextualizing Reiki in that time. And she and I have been able to exchange a lot. I mean, because her English isn't very good, and my Japanese is still developing. And so we've been able to exchange a lot of research with each other. And so, it's been a wonderful partnership with her. She and I kind of worked on some of this Hawaii stuff together. And I'm kind of continuing that research now, and she's kind of continuing the Tokyo side of the research. And eventually, I think both of us are interested in learning more about your grandmother. We know we just have certain documents and whatever, but kind of filling in the gaps. That there are these big gaps in her teaching career. Like, for example, the 1950s.
Excuse me, Justin. I just need to interrupt you a bit.
Sure.
We're just at the edge of running out of time, and I don't want to go into this, although it's very interesting. So we might have to do another show and
pose on
the edge of the cliff.
These are, you know, people that's where I am right now. I mean, there's all this road ahead of me that I don't know what it holds. You know,
right.
I, this is where I'm at right now, is kind of talking with these older women in Hawaii and learning about their experiences. And it's very exciting for me.
Right. Yeah. So one of the things that I just would like to add as a little piece to your research in Hawaii is that what I've discovered in my 30 years of teaching practice, but also in talking to all these different people, is that it may be that she did teach a bit differently, because I think our teaching as a master, my teaching has developed, but I don't find that the core has changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that to be true about my grandmother, but it is a critical assumption. But the other part that I see is that the people who are students hear what they hear in that moment.
Sure.
And the most important thing is to put that into your equation. I would like for you to do that so that the assumption doesn't lie totally on her method of teaching, but also culturally what people are willing to hear.
Mm. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean? It's definitely a two-way street. But the other variable is that these women are, you know, very elderly, some of them, and their memories, you know, that's the other variable is when you find these inconsistencies, you know, well, when I talked to her this time, she said this, and when I talked to her that time, she said that, and that doesn't make sense. You know, you have to kind of think about, okay, well, what makes the most, you know, what makes the most sense? Because, memory, like, you know, the one thing I think science is showing us, memory, is we're constantly reconstructing our pasts.
Right. And it's possible that both can be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to talk to you more about this, and I think we need to sign off.
Okay.
And perhaps what would be great and is for us to make another appointment and to begin where we left off.
Well, I'm near the end. I mean, I'm near my present right now, and I'm almost at the end of my limits. But yeah, I'd love to talk with you some more. So I hope we can make that happen.
Great, great. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you, Phyllis.
This is Phyllis Murumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.